argument next in appeal number 2009-1415, Gillig versus Nike. Silverman, good morning. Yes,
good morning.
You may proceed.
Your honors. This is a matter that involves a number of very fundamental concepts in our jurisprudence. First and foremost among these is the concept of jurisdiction and the meaning or implications which flow from a determination by a court that it does not have jurisdiction. We have a situation here where the district court had concluded it did not have jurisdiction by reason of lack of standing of the party known as TTG for abbreviation of a longer corporate name. So TTG, who was the plaintiff in the original case, was determined at a point in time 4.5 years after the original case was filed not to have received an adequate or sufficient either assignment or right to pursue a cause of action predicated on an assignment. And in my opinion, there's some area of ambiguity there, but it's not germane to the issues before this body. So the
district court considered this issue as a matter of summary judgment, following the line of cases, starting with the McBeath case, and felt that this was intertwined with the merits, and therefore the merits of who had title to these trade secrets, and therefore decided it, as I understand it, at your client's urging on the merits as a matter for summary judgment.
Let me address that, Your Honor. What my client had urged in what the parties in their briefs refer to as TTG1, the first of the two of these cases, is that the issue of standing be decided upon summary judgment standings, not that that all elements or any other element necessary to prove appropriation of a trade secret be determined. What we agreed to be determined on summary judgment principles, in other words, to draw out to whatever factual predicate the court might have to weigh in order to make a determination on that issue of standing, was limited simply to that, because there was no or would be no jurisdiction if the plaintiff had no standing to begin with.
You're arguing, let me be sure I understand what you've just told us, which is that the request that the decision be made on summary judgment is procedurally no different than a 12B1 motion for purposes of determining the jurisdictional question of standing. Is that what you're now telling us?
Yes, and particularly given that the lapse of such a period of time, it seemed more appropriate that whatever facts had been generated during that period of pendency be a part of the court's consideration.
Well, does it really make a difference which it is? Suppose it is a dismissal on the merits, but that would be a determination that TTG did not have a claim. It wouldn't necessarily be a determination that Gillig didn't have a claim. In fact, it's a determination that you could view it as a determination that Gillig retained the ownership. That's what the court seemed to be saying.
That is how we construed it, and we certainly would not have brought the second action if we hadn't construed it that way. Now, when all we got into the briefing after dismissal of the second case, then we frankly scrutinized with much more detail what the court had ruled at the end of the first case.
Well, what I'm saying is that even if the first one were viewed as a dismissal on the merits of a TTG claim, that's not res judicata as to a claim by Gillick.
We feel we agree with that, but we also feel strongly that the merits, in any event, were never reached in TTG 1. And because the merits were never reached, then the issue of privity is academic.
Mm-hmm.
I have some other remarks.
I'd like you to address the statute of limitations issue, because
certainly.
That's an alternative ground here. And
yes.
I know that doesn't affect the inventorship claim, but it does potentially affect the trade secret claim.
Well, I believe my adversary has raised res judicata as a defense to all of our claims.
Yes, I understand
yes.
that. But,
yes.
But the statute of limitations issue is raised as a defense to the trade secret claim, right?
That's
so even
correct.
If you win on res judicata,
we've
still got the statute of limitations issue.
Yes,
right.
You do.
And indeed, doesn't the statute of limitations issue pretty well dispose of the trade secret argument, so that the only thing left is inventorship? Misread that?
That is correct. That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. So let me address the statute of limitations issue then. Our position is that there are two essential principles under Texas law. There's equitable tolling and there's legal tolling. Legal tolling is perhaps more easily defined, and it's really...
There is no legal tolling here, is there? There's no statute or rule.
No, it's not a statute. Texas law, as we read the case law, is applicable to statute of limitations as it would apply to the trade secret claims.
But there was nothing that prohibited Mr. Gillick from joining the litigation, from seeking to join the litigation, or from TTG, from seeking to amend the complaint to add Mr. Gillick?
Well, Your Honor, I'm glad you raised that question. Because that's exactly what Mr. Gillick did try to do at the conclusion of TTG1, for Frank, before the conclusion.
Maybe he waited a little too long, but there's nothing that would have prevented him had he started in a more timely fashion, shall we say.
There's nothing that prevented him from starting a new suit.
Well, if I could address the questions in sequence,
sure.
Your Honors. Mr. Gillick had received in excess of 80% of the stock of the company in what he believed was in consideration for the conveyance of his trade secrets to the corporate plaintiff in TTG1. So the issue or the question that there might have been some inadequacy or some deficiency in this transfer never entered his mind until 4+ years after TTG1 was filed, when it did arise as an issue he promptly moved to be joined or to substitute in under Rule 17, which Nike opposed, and the court ruled in Nike's favor that he could not join. Now, with that in hand, now turning to your question, Your Honor, in theory, Mr. Gillick could then have gone off and started a standalone piece of litigation. However, the determination on the issue of standing was still before the Fifth Circuit. So under Texas law and to our knowledge, all applicable statute of limitations law, and when the right of one party or a party turns upon the determination of a right or a non-right of another party, that is a permissible delay as long as the defendant is on notice in all respects of the nature of the claim. And that is really the essence of both the legal and equitable tolling principles that are involved. as far as the statute of limitations is involved. There was no secret here. Nike was fully aware of the Nate. There was no surprise. There was nothing new, as a matter of fact, other than the inventorship claims, which arose in the case of 7 of the 8 patents after the date of filing.
But don't these Texas equitable tolling cases go on the proposition that the second suit is not barred because it could not have been brought until the conclusion of the first suit? And you've just conceded here that Gillig could have brought a suit without waiting for the conclusion of the first suit.
Perhaps I didn't say it well, Your Honor, saying it would not have been. He could have brought it, but it would not have been appropriate. Possibly it would have been a Rule 11 violation, because he would not have known that he had, whether or not he had a right to bring the second suit until the first matter was resolved. That is, yes, he physically could have filed it at a courthouse, but it would not have been an appropriate filing, because he could not have been aware whether or not he had a right to file the second action until the resolution of the first action.
You were into your rebuttal. Would you like to reserve
your time?
Yes,
I'd like to reserve, yes.
All right, very good. Mr. Rank, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to first address the issue of whether Mr. Gillig could have joined the case. In January of 2004, when the complaint was filed in this case, we immediately responded by saying, we deny the allegation that Triple T Golf has any ownership rights in these trade secrets. We propounded production requests asking for written assignment documents. I personally deposed Mr. Gillig twice and asked about the assignments, and I got conflicting testimony about, I think there's a document, I don't know if there's a document. The case progressed all the way up to the Fifth Circuit and back, and on the eve of trial the second time, Judge McBride looked at me and asked whether we're still contesting standing, and I said yes, because we don't know who owns these rights. Judge McBride then turned to counsel and said, is there a written assignment? And for the first time, we learned there was a written assignment document. At that time, we learned there were board resolution documents and special shareholder meeting documents that hadn't been produced, and when they were produced, the judge conducted a deposition of Triple T Golf in his courtroom. Mr. Gillig was the witness on his own behalf and on the company's behalf, and that's when the judge determined, essentially, he was at a loss to know who owned these rights, because in those resolutions, there were all kinds of references to securing the rights from individuals such as Claire Laux and the Elizabeth Gillig J. Gillig Trust. And at that time, the judge gave the parties an opportunity to supplement the summary judgment record, and he listened to the submission, or looked at the submission that Triple T propounded, and said, I'm still at a loss. And if you look at appendix pages 409 to 415, he uses those very words as to who has ownership interest in these rights. And as a result, he wouldn't conclude that Mr. Gillig was the true party in interest under Rule 17. So there's been no determination that Mr. Gillig is, in fact, to this day, the true owner of the trade secrets. But
what about the ownership of the patent rights?
Yes, the patent rights.
Ownership and inventorship.
Inventorship, yeah. The inventorship counts of the complaint here are brought by Gillig, right?
That's a little bit unclear, but.
Well, I don't think it's unclear. I think it's pretty clear. It's what the counts state. That is a claim by Gillig for a correction of inventorship.
To the extent that that is the case, if you look at paragraph 55 of the complaint, the January 2004 complaint, Triple T Golf said, essentially, Nike began allegedly using these so-called trade secrets in the patenting process as early as 2001. At the end of discovery in 2005, Triple T sought leave to add inventorship counts, and said they arise out of the same transaction or occurrence. So this goes to the issue of same claim, whether the claims could have been brought.
Yeah, but I don't think you're answering my question. What is your position as to whether Gillig, put aside res judicata, put aside statute of limitations, let's suppose that those issues are out of the case, what is your position as to who has the inventorship claim?
The inventorship claim is essentially barred under res judicata principles. I don't think you can
understand. Forget about that. Put that to one side. Suppose we rule against you on both res judicata and statute of limitations, just hypothetically, okay? Who owns the inventorship claim?
Mr. Gillig arguably owned the inventorship claim, but it's barred by res judicata. I don't think you can divorce him, with all due respect, Your Honor, and here's why.
We can ask hypothetical questions. You know, we do that all the time.
I understand. I understand, and I'm trying to answer the question. But if I may go back to the time when the Fifth Circuit remanded the case after being misled about when these patent applications came to the fore, the Fifth Circuit in 2007 said, gee, I think patents are relevant. I think they're relevant to this case. Go back and add them. At which time, Triple T Golf didn't seek leave to add any of the patents, and all of the 8 patents that were at issue, or that are at issue in the second lawsuit, had issued at that point in time.
But if the claim was Gillig's claim and not Triple T's claim, then why would it have been added?
Well, Mr.
Gillig wasn't a party to that lawsuit.
But again, that's why, with all due respect, I think you have to look at the privity issue in the context of res judicata. Mr. Gillig was the only employee of Triple T Golf. He owned 80% of the company. He was the only witness who testified on behalf of the company. He went to every settlement conference. Ostensibly, he hired counsel. He is the individual who controlled the case. And under res judicata privity rules, he was in privity with the company and could have raised those claims, just as he could have been named himself as a party plaintiff.
He's in privity with respect to the inventorship claim, which he owns? I'm having trouble understanding that.
Well, I think, again, if you look back at the res judicata doctrine in the Fifth Circuit, you look at the privity in the context of the parties. Were they identical or were they in privity? Then you look at the transactional test. And all of the claims arose out of the 2000 meeting between Mr. Stites and Mr. Gillig. So if you go back to the transactional test, all these claims had to have been raised. Just as Mr. Gillig could have been named as a party, he was, in essence, in privity with the company. And these issues could have been raised. At the time, Triple T Golf raised the issue of inventorship in 2005 and tried to add patents, there was no argument that it didn't own the rights.
Do you agree that under our decisions in MediaTek and University of Pittsburgh, that if the dismissal here was for lack of standing, that there is no res judicata bar?
There's a res judicata bar here because the court exercised jurisdiction under a very specific body of Fifth Circuit law, McBeath.
You're not answering my question. If we follow MediaTek and University of Pittsburgh, which both seem to be directly in point, then there's and we consider the dismissal to have been for lack of standing, you lose, right?
If the dismissal was for lack of standing on the res judicata issue, yes. But again, I believe that MediaTek was distinguishable.
Because
it was Ninth Circuit law that was applied. There's no indication that the Ninth Circuit follows the same test that the Fifth Circuit does insofar as converting the jurisdictional question to a full trial or full adjudication on the merits. And that's what we have here. And if you read MediaTek, it was a clear standing issue. If you read this case, appellant's behest, the district court converted the jurisdictional question to a full decision on the merits. It wasn't summary judgment on jurisdictional issues. If they would have adduced summary judgment evidence of 2 of the 3 elements of a trade secret.
I don't understand how it can be a bar even if it were a merits decision, because it would only be a merits decision that TTG didn't own the trademark.
No, actually, it's a merits-based decision, with all due respect, Your Honor, on 2 of the 3 elements of a trade secret's cause of action under Texas law. Under Texas law, Guy versus Carpenter, which is cited in our brief, you have to show ownership of a trade secret and a confidential relationship, and then use or misappropriation of the trade secret.
Well, but even under your view, if it were a merits decision, it was just a merits decision on the ownership issue, right?
No, it was a merits-based decision on 2 of the 3 essential elements of the cause of action, because
cause of action? The inventorship cause of action?
The trade secret.
Or the trade secret cause of action?
Yes, Your Honor, the trade secret's cause of action. And as a result, then the court looked...
Well, I don't understand your theory. I mean, I at least understand what you're saying when you say, well, if it was a merits decision, it was a merits decision that determined that TTG didn't have ownership. But how could it be anything beyond that?
Well, if you look at the Fifth Circuit, the district court's decision, he struggled with 2 elements of the cause of action when he converted the jurisdictional question to a full decision on the merits, to a ruling on the merits. And he said, there are 2 elements that you have to prove, and I need to know whether Triple T Golf has both of them. I need to know, A, whether they own the trade secrets, in other words, whether they were assigned, and I need to know, B, whether the confidential relationship, the alleged confidential relationship between Mr. Gillig.
Where did the district court rule on the confidential relationship issue?
When the district court dismissed the case initially that went up on appeal and was affirmed in his decision at pages.
This is the summary judgment motion.
This is the summary judgment motion, yes.
So you're saying the summary judgment motion was not limited to the question of who owned the trade secret, but went beyond
also who,
that.
Correct. Also who owned the
issues.
Confidential relationship. If you look at A378.
Who owned the confidential relationship?
Right.
378?
A378 and A415, I believe.
But even if that's true, the puzzle is how did the district court reach those merits issues if there was no, if one of the issues was who owned the trade secret? And the district court concludes TTG did not own it.
To answer your question, Your Honor, the district court reached the decision on the merits after agreeing with Triple T Golf that when the jurisdictional issue is intertwined on the facts with the merits, you accept jurisdiction, you exercise jurisdiction, and you determine the underlying merits-based issues. And McBeath case, the Sierra Club case, the Continental Can case, the whole litany of cases that the district court cited to in support of this proposition is what it relied on to decide the issue on the merits. And what it essentially decided is Triple T Golf didn't deduce summary judgment evidence on two issues, ownership of the trade secret and ownership of the confidential relationship.
Well, no, I don't understand the second thing. I mean, the page that you pointed us to, he says he concludes they lack standing and that the ownership claims element of plaintiff's alleged cause of action cannot be proved by plaintiff. That is only addressing the ownership issue.
A378.
You mentioned another page as well.
415, I believe.
Again, referring to ownership interests. He doesn't say anything about the lack of a confidential relationship. I don't know what you're talking about.
With all due respect, Your Honor, if you read the last sentence, it says, well, I can read the entire sentence so it's in context. The dismissal is appropriate by reason of plaintiff's failure to establish standing, as well as because of the failure of the summary judgment record to raise a genuine issue of fact as to an essential element of plaintiff's claim that Gillig assigned to plaintiff whatever rights Gillig acquired from his dealings with Stites in September.
As he refers to that up above, that's a determination that TTG lacked the ownership interest.
He said whatever rights Gillig acquired from Stites. That means an agreement. We're interpreting that to mean an agreement to keep in confidence the information that was exchanged.
I don't see how you can interpret that.
Well, that's the only possible element of the cause of action that Mr. Gillig could have acquired from Mr. Stites during that meeting, because the other issue is the transfer of the so-called trade secrets, which he would not have acquired from Mr. Stites. Those are rights that he already possessed. So,
is there any reference in this thing to confidential relationship?
Those are the two references that I'm aware of. I can provide a supplemental citation.
So he doesn't use the words confidential relationship.
I don't believe that he did, but if I can provide citations to the two issues when he converted this standing issue to a decision on the merits. I can provide citations to the two elements being of concern to him, again, one being the assignment of the rights and the second being the assignment of what he acquired from Mr. Stites, which is the agreement to allegedly keep in confidence the information.
In order to get where you want us to go, we have to buy this intertwining concept, don't we?
I think you have to follow Fifth Circuit law, which is what the district court did and which is what the Fifth Circuit affirmed on. If you look at A378, and this was a final judgment of the Fifth Circuit that the district court cited in his decision dismissing this case. He said it's clear to him that the district court also dismissed on the merits because in addition to talking about the summary judgment issues, it talked about the other summary judgment issue, which was whether Triple T Golf was a consumer under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and that's a substantive issue. So the Fifth Circuit, by the letter of its decision, seemingly issued a final judgment on the merits of this case. I see I have 2 minutes left. I'd like to address the statute of limitations issues. First, with respect to statute of limitations, there's no, no dispute that the statute of limitations is told. This lawsuit was filed 5 years and 8 months after Mr. Gildig knew or should have known of the alleged misappropriation of the trade secrets. It's 2 years and 8 months late. The two doctrines that are...
Did you say no dispute it was told?
I'm sorry, no dispute that it ran. I apologize. Thank you for correcting me. I
was going to say that's for the record. Do you mean that?
I understand. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. There's no dispute that it ran. The action was filed two years and 8 months late. In the context of legal tolling under Texas law, a second action the second action has to be based upon some determination that in the first case. So the viability of the second case has to be contingent upon the first case. Here, the first case wasn't about who owned the trade secrets as between Mr. Gillig and Triple T Golf. So legal tolling doesn't apply. Mr. Gillig could clearly have filed this lawsuit on his own. He could have joined in the lawsuit when it was filed at the outset.
How about equitable tolling?
Under equitable tolling, under U.S. versus Petty, there has to be... First of all, it's a rare and exceptional circumstance when equitable tolling is applied. And the circumstance has to be external to the party. Here, the whole issue of who was joined and when they were joined were decisions made clearly by Mr. Gillig and counsel, nothing external. Again, back in 2004 when we contested the issue of who owned the so-called trade secrets, we said, be put to your proofs. They could have corrected the issue. There was nothing external here at all. So I see I'm about out of time. For all the reasons that we set forth in our brief, we respectfully request that the district court be affirmed in all respects.
Okay, Mr. Rank, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Silverman? We have a little over 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll try to be brief here. I would like to emphasize the impracticality, if not the ethical...
Mr. Silverman, speak up, please,
yes,
sir.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes. I'd like to address the statute of limitations issue and just to amplify upon some of my earlier remarks. In our view, Mr. Gillig could not have appropriately filed a parallel claim to have alleged standing in one case while a company in which he was an 80% stockholder was suing for exactly the same thing in another, possibly even the same federal district court. I think it is fantasy to suggest that that could have in any way been proper. Mr. Gillig was the vice president. He had responsibility for managing the litigation. He was a principal actor in the alleged appropriation of trade secrets. For him to have gone out on his own in a separate direction in some other district court, had it not been unethical, it almost would certainly have been dismissed rather promptly. But we don't think that is a sensible...
Why would it have been dismissed? He could have brought a contingent claim saying, there's a litigation going on as to the ownership of this property. We think that TTG owns the trade secrets, but if there's a determination that they don't, and I'm the owner, here's my claim.
Sir.
And he could file a protective lawsuit, and then presumably the lawsuit would be stayed rather than dismissed. I don't understand why it has to be dismissed just because it's contingent.
Yes. Your Honor, had Mr. Gillig had any inkling that the validity of his assignment of his trade secret claims to his corporation were questionable or dubious or vulnerable to attack, he would have taken or considered action along those lines. You have to consider his position.
But the ownership issue was being challenged before the statute of limitations ran, wasn't it?
It was referenced as an affirmative defense, and then as Mr. Rank pointed out, in discovery approximately 2 years after the case was filed, a request was made of whether or not the assignment had occurred in writing or otherwise. Mr. Gillig, in his testimony, I think on various occasions, indicated that it was an oral assignment. As a matter of fact, this corporate document to which Mr. Rank refers itself was never an assignment per se. It was simply a confirmation that he had made an oral assignment, that that was the reason that he had received his stock. So there was no written assignment. There was a written resolution that confirmed that he had made an oral assignment approximately 3 weeks after his meeting with this predecessor entity to Nike Golf. So that is the reason. Had the man had a crystal ball, I guess, yes, he could have filed such a contingent action. He's not an attorney. He's a technical person. And none of the lawyers had any reason to doubt, as we try to amplify in our reply brief, none of the lawyers had any reason to doubt the validity of the oral assignment under Florida law.
Any final point?
Yes. That the inventorship claims, in any event, are not subject to any statute of limitations argument, and certainly res judicata, even if it is somehow found to have survived the University of Pittsburgh and Media Tech, would have no bearing on Gillig's rights to proceed on his inventorship claims.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.